The Hot 4 podcast is proudly brought to you by Charles Farram. Charles Farram have been sellers of hops since 1865 and hop growers for even longer. They stock nitrogen-flushed leaf hops, T90s and T45 pellets, and to ensure their hops remain in optimum condition, they have state-of-the-art cold stores at their sites in Worcestershire and Yakima in the USA. At charlesfarram.com, brewers can shop by pay-as-you-go or using agreed credit terms for yeast, malt, fruit purees and other brewing products. In addition to leading hop varieties from across the world, the Farrams family range brings you Archer, Emperor, Godiva, Harlequin, Jester, Most, Mystic, Olicana and Opus from their hop development program right here in the UK. If you'd like more information or expert advice, visit the Brewers Resource and FAQ pages on the website or contact their technical advisors for different uses, applications and recipes. They're always really happy to help. Visit charlesfarram.com today. That's charlesfarram.com. I'm Nick.
And I'm Sean.
And these are our Fermenting Thoughts. Welcome back to Fermenting Thoughts. You all right, Sean?
Very well, thank you.
You hesitated then. I thought you were like, no, everything's falling apart.
I'm rock solid. And
amazing.
It's all part of slowing my brain down recently. You know, one has to consider one's actual status, you know, and say, hang on, don't get anxious. You're actually totally all right. You're in a nice, quiet space having a chat. You've had a coffee. I'm very all right, thank you.
Everything is well with the world. Well, today we're going to tackle a really, really, really deep topic. So just buckle up, because it's going to get existential. You're going to be questioning your very existence, your identity and purpose in life, because we're going to talk about brewery packaging and containers. Hopefully I said that really beautifully. So brewery packaging and containers and kegs, casks, bottles, cans, where do you want to start with all that, Sean?
Oh, huge, isn't it?
Huge, massive.
And we're, by the way, we start this with the fact that neither of us are experts on this, but again, from a pre-planning perspective, from a sustainability angle, I think is where I'm going to start it, which is that in future-proofing various parts of your production business, you know, everybody can follow the trend and suddenly start, you know, top-heavy canning against keg, or you just really analyse to the best of your ability before you set out the path and what extra equipment you need. On a general commentary, I would suggest that go for the best packaging you can, because direct to consumer is definitely the way forward. If you can take control of that off various platforms and direct from your brewery, then the only thing that's then potentially compromising you is your courier usage. And to be fair to the couriers, they need the most robust packaging that they can get. By that, of course, I'm talking about breakages and other bits and pieces that look poor for the end user.
Well, there's a story on that. I recently sent some Emmanuels to a bottle shop in London, and complete rookie error on my part. They went in a single line box, which I thought would be okay in with them being cans. Most of my cans go local, but these ones were heading to the big smoke. And they were supposed to turn up next day. They didn't, even though I paid for next day delivery. So it was a few days before they'd arrived. They sat in a very, very, very hot warehouse, and the cans had ballooned at the bottom. And yes, I'm going to hold my hands up. I did final gravity readings. It all seemed pretty stable. It was a Saison with some fruit in it, and the other one was a Belgian blonde that had some dextrose in it, a boosty ABV. Evidently, there's been some re-fermentation in package because of the heat. I'm just going to be transparent, because I'd be twattish of me to suggest that I've got it down when I haven't. These are very real problems that brewers of any size and shape have if you're putting into pack unfiltered, unpasteurised beer. And obviously, it reflected bad on me and made me look a bit foolish.
Yeah.
And they couldn't sell them, and I lost money on it.
Yeah, and if you do have a problem, make sure you consolidate it with your courier as quickly as possible. And obviously, the bigger the courier network or names that we all know are out there. So do your research. If it's a local courier that you can, again, form a more bonded, immediate relationship with, these are the critical issues that impact on service and reliability of product and dispense, of course. I think that part of
the business chain I've always thought was a false economy, and I'm talking about end-to-end user, because we're going to talk about other vessels in a minute at the point of use, cask, keg, etc. And what used to happen, of course, is the brewery would look after that chain and do cellar controls and management and cellar master of the year. But in the indie scene, you've either got to be competent in that or admit that you're not, and say to your supplier, well, actually, I don't know that much about it. It's not a Sankey fitting. It's an E-type Jaguar fitting. Just be realistic. You know, people are not going to go and want to start using obscure fittings just to appease you or just because you think that's right for your product. Be robust and know how to fix the technical problems for your customers.
Yeah. I sometimes think there's a danger in breweries, and particularly with some brewers, probably on the more inexperienced end. And I used to totally have this mindset, and I had to unlearn this mindset when I encountered problems. You know, when I was working in a 10-barrel brewery, that once that beer's gone into package and it's in the shop or in the pub, it's not my problem anymore. They've bought it and it's not my issue. I don't need to think any more about it. But when a pub owner, bar owner, craft beer venue, whatever, phones up and says, well, your keg that's been dry hopped but hasn't had any decent filtration has clogged up my line and I've had to pay someone to come in and clear it, that's a massive issue. Now, obviously, that issue shouldn't happen in the first place because you need some good QA in place to ensure that doesn't happen. And I wish I could say that it doesn't happen and the industry's got to a point now it's starting to mature that people have learnt, but they haven't. Even some of the big breweries, I noticed a post on a pub owner Facebook group that they were getting casks from a very, very sizable brewery where it was just pouring foam. And other people were saying, yeah, we've had the same issue on there. And we're talking like a very well-known cask ale brand. And it seemed, or was suggested from the post, that the brewery weren't really doing much about that. And I don't think that's acceptable.
It's totally unacceptable. We know that, you know, name-checking, but they're not the only ones, so I'm only saying it because I happen to know. But Fuller's, once Asahi had taken over, stripped out of that whole quality control function out in market for their tenanted and leased estate. And it's not name-checking Fuller's, because loads of brewers, or a lot of them, have done this. And, of course, as I said earlier, it's a false economy. My own experience was with some American brand that I was building, and we were in Potainers, and the fact of the matter is, to the uninitiated or to operations now, where again nobody's dedicated in-house or experienced, not even GMs these days. So I came up through the ranks, and I was like, did a bar job as a young fella, early days of Wetherspoons, and I was given good cellar training, for which I'm still grateful. But it's just not there anymore. And so, you know, anything that's different, the staff just don't know, they're nervous about it, being given no instruction. So going back to my own story, it was a big pub group, it was a division of a big pub group that we were supplying. It was fantastic that we were in there on pour, but we were supplying in Potainers, and Potainers at that time used to pop on Connect B. It was just part of what they did. There's no, it wasn't dangerous in any manner, but it was just that slight pop on Connect. But to the average bar staff member who's now expected to connect kegs, and you know, there was no prep done by a cellar manager or tapping cask for that matter, it was frightening and made them very nervous. And so as a consequence, I ended up having to babysit that whole estate and saying, no, it's quite normal, and having to go in and allay their fears and train them up and not just send them a technical PDF. That's no use to anybody. There's no, we all know it, it's out there in service in general. You talk to somebody virtually, you talk to somebody from a call centre that's not even in the country. Same principle. Go in, make sure that all of your accounts are happy with the way the product's meant to be connected, how it's meant to look on port, everything to do with its final conditioning.
Yeah. Well, should we go through each container then? Like, so we'll look at cans, look at bowls, look at kegs and casks. Just discuss them, maybe look at ways that brewers and hospitality venues can handle those containers better, any tips, etc., etc. Should we start with kegs, maybe?
Yep. Do you have any strong opinions?
Well, yeah, I mean, we were just saying earlier about when we were discussing what we were going to chat about, and I was saying about the sustainability aspects and carbon footprint when it comes to kegs. You've got steel kegs and you've got plastic kegs, and there's a lot of discussion that's starting to come to the forefront now about the usage of those two things. And you'll have discussion about recyclability of plastic kegs versus the weight of metal kegs being transported and picked up from said venue, and then the cleaning chemicals and the carbon footprint. And I was saying, well, how do you measure carbon footprint? The example I gave to Sean earlier before I hit record was about how, as a family, we're moving to a more sustainable diet. So starting to strip a lot of the meat out of our family diet, and how we're using corn sausages. But corn sausages are, I would imagine, are highly processed. And I thought, I was holding the bag, I wonder what the CO2 footprint of this is. Because obviously I'm mindful that if you're eating meat, particularly red meat, that's obviously the emissions off the back of that are pretty high. And on the bag itself was like, oh, for every two sausages, there are 450 grams, don't quote me on that, but it was within that region, of CO2. That's the carbon footprint. But then I thought, well, how's that being measured? Is that just measured by production? Is that measured by their warehousing? Bet that doesn't take into account the vehicles it travels to the supermarkets in. Doesn't account for their refrigeration, doesn't account for my car, bringing it home. And it's very hard to measure the true carbon footprint of, in this instance, a keg. I feel strongly about the plastic stuff because I do think, like, we often talk about recycling, and yes, absolutely, we should recycle, but the better thing is not to use plastic in the first place and drive the demand for plastics. And I just wonder what your thoughts were when it came to kegs on that front, before we even get into the, is my beer right to go in a keg?
There's notably not easily accessible resource material, so I'm not going to suddenly come out with, but there are sources that we're acquainted with, and you just have to drill down on the normal Google search, and they offer free spreadsheets in which, or other documents to which you can populate from, and grateful we all are that these are free. So a bit like Mr. Beer Nouveau on Whole Duty recently, he's done some tremendous work on those sort of documents for the purposes of calculating alcohol duty. Go to those resources on the net. We both, myself and Nick, know a chap called Chris Terry, who has his own company. We'll be dropping that into a future podcast, who is a bit like Beer Nouveau in the sustainable eco world. And get those resources, combine them, and implement them in your business. In terms of the variety of kegs out there, again, that's not one for me to state categorically one should be doing this and that, because at the end of the day, it's all down to the package you get offered by said kegger. And we all know that it's about reclaiming those kegs, getting those kegs back. Yeah, if they are one ways, they are one ways. But again, a good source of value and standards on this is Ivan at Jolly Good Beer, always has been, but there's, again, various other voices out there. And go to these sort of people to understand what, as a distributor in Ivan's case, at Jolly Good Beer, are you genuinely able, in the majority of your accounts as end users, to recycle those kegs? Is there a point at which, or will your distributor, as in the case of Jolly Good Beer, you know, advise you on that? Again, that's all part of service and sustainability. So, yeah, go to the resources on the net. I'm sorry that's a bit vague as a reply, Nick, to your keg supplier, one way or steels, you need to establish, like any service that we might purchase, that they're competent in doing that. Yeah. And giving you the appropriate recycling advice, disposal advice, and or scan in and out advice.
Yeah. The other thing when it comes to kegs, which I absolutely love your opinion on, is, and I have this conversation so often with brewers, is why is it that a brewer can command a higher price for the same beer that's in keg as they can in cask? I talk to loads of brewers that are really surprised when they're like, oh, I'll package this, you know, session IPA in keg, and I get at least £10 to £20 more before VAT for the keg than I do for the exact same beer that goes in cask. Even though the liquid volume in cask is just over 10 litres more than in a 30-litre keg. And I found that at the brewery I worked in. Exact same beer, two packaging formats, the cask doesn't hold the value that the keg does.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and not one I can answer immediately, it's the honest truth. I think you're looking at the volume usage relative to your balance sheet. So if you're a cask-driven brewery, then clearly that's going to tip the balance in terms of, you know, how many keg formats or how many formats are you packaging in? And then you've just got to do one of those proper analysis of it and how it weights to it. It's a bit like your wet-dry split
in a restaurant or bar, you've got to say, right, okay, how many casks against kegs at the moment? Definitive answer to your core question, I'm not sure. One for our listeners, please.
I have an opinion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's the right answer or even the right opinion, yeah. But you know what they say, opinions like arseholes, everyone's got one. Whether you want to air it or not is another question. I think it's about perceived value. I think there is a higher perceived value of beer on keg than in cask, which to me as a brewer is completely backwards, knowing that the effort that goes into storing, cellaring and dispensing cask beer far outstrips keg. Like, you can stick the Sankey fitting or whatever fitting you've got onto the keg, turn the gas on at the right PSI, and all going well, if the brewer hasn't overcarbonated the beer or you've not turned the gas up too high and you've got the right equilibrium, that beer will just pour beautifully in a glass. When it comes to like casks, we all know this to this, you know, but the pub, it goes on a stillage, or, you know, you use the cask wedge red things that go in the cask to do it vertically. You vent it, you leave it for a day or two to re-ferment, and then you serve it and you've got that narrow window. That to me seems like a more value-driven experience for a unique product, and yet we treat cask like a poor relation.
Beautifully answered.
Thanks. In this case, I did well to air my opinion.
Certainly did. No, I'm sorry, I didn't think deeply enough about it. But I certainly can answer it more competently. That is the only answer that makes sense.
We've talked a little bit about kegs. Obviously, the cask element ties into that, I think, unless you've got any other observations on casks.
I just think you're always going to get... I think that we're... You know, yes, we know we're in tough times and all the rest of it, but all of us are chastened by, I'm sure, on a daily basis, is that if... And any business, whatever business you're in, if you're not keeping an eye on what you are offering in terms of service around your vessel, then somebody will quickly take your place. That's what I do love about open market competition. And so, again, as a business, re-looking at your utility contract or getting out of it if you can, or engaging on not on a fixed contract but a variable or whatever is bespoke to the needs of your business, you must do with your vessels and packaging, because there are a lot of excellent options and new ones coming through all the time.
I wonder whether tying into this applies for both on licensed large pack cask and keg. I wonder whether, particularly for cask, something that's lacking from some breweries is the point of sale material to help promote the beer. And this does tie into something I wanted to bring up about small pack, like cans and bottles. We all know people buy with their eyes first and foremost, so the pump clip or the keg clip is the first point of entry. And I know a lot of people won't want to hear this, because the stock response is, but they all get stolen. You know what, I'm gonna bring up glassware, right? If you've got a glass and it's got your branding on and your beer is served in that glass in that pub, and there is a bar runner with your branding on and some beer mats, obviously the branding and the look all builds up a picture alongside the quality of the beer, which also is the ultimate aim of making good beer and people having a really enjoyable experience through the whole thing. That, I think, can help premiumise the experience for a consumer.
Massively so. As a past operator, really grateful for this question. I always felt that, again, like everything else, the conversation just about vessels, it's like you work with your brand and they should be very ordered at their end, where they say, right, okay, based on our agreement and the friendly partnership going forward, we're looking forward to the year ahead. And on the basis of the volume of sales that you've signed the contract on or agreed to, we will give you this point of sale activation kit. And this is more macro language, but the fact of the matter is it should apply to every single supplier. And so you say, right, okay, we've got 10 pubs. We're doing 3 kegs a week of your brand per pub. So based on that, you get a starter kit of 2 cases of glasses a week, you know, 6 T-shirts, you know, a pack of beer mats, et cetera, et cetera. But as a rider, we will not resupply that glassware until month 6 based on attrition rate, because the attrition rate is not our responsibility. You are the licensee and business, and you know, certainly when I was running bars, and I'm talking seriously busy urban operations, it was part of my checklist and expectation of my floor team to clear those glasses, even on a Friday night, sharpish, and retrieve them and back behind the bar and re-clean them back out there and or moving towards clean down, so that, yeah, you're going to get marginal attrition. I'm not being naive about that.
But you wouldn't leave your car door open with the keys in the ignition, would you?
And you can reduce that attrition rate significantly if you're operating your establishment correctly. So it's certainly not the responsibility of the brand to keep supplying you, of which, by the way, you know, again, because of, it's like anything else, if you're given it free, don't take care of it, you don't feel responsible for it. And also, a lot of it ends up in the cellar, and it's a nonsense trail. So everybody's got to be keen to the mission and only ask for point-of-sale material that's realistic to your trading environment, is going to be utilised for the benefit of what it's designed for, which is visibility and aesthetic.
I wonder whether there's some incentives that breweries can offer to venues to use that stuff, rather than like, oh, here's a massive wadge of beer mats. Because that's just abdicating responsibility. I wonder whether even something as simple as like, look, we'll give you a discount on the first keg or kegs you're purchasing over however many weeks on the condition that the staff wear these T-shirts.
Absolutely. That should be a given. Only fair.
You know, because the staff have got to be clothed,
yeah.
Unless it's some kind of like swinging.
And it is all that old school. So I still say it about, you know, everybody talks about social media. A lot of disinformation and actually not on message visibility for branding can happen in the digital world. There's still nout wrong with behind the bar reinforcement, and certainly T-shirts being one of them, clearly on the bar staff. There's nout wrong with old style A boards and internal boards. Yes, I know we've got digital screens to tell you what the beer choices are in the tap room, and that's great. But don't forget the basic line of sight material that the inbound punter sees. I mean, I remember did a merchandising course years and years ago, and it's fascinating if you do one and revisit them by all means with the companies that supply you. I know that Diageo at the time did one where you look at the visual back bar merchandising, and the way the actual eye works, it tends to go toward the vertical. So you tier your products in a certain fashion at a certain angle, and yeah, there's a lot of work, like all these things, being done on this. But that's the way the human brain works, and it will be drawn to that point. So external to the property, as I've just said, you know, that's the first place they're coming towards the door, aren't they? It's got to look to therefore employ the point of sale material there. If it's a branded, like I said, A board.
I'll just end with these two when we talk about large pack examples. In the hotel we stayed in last night, there was an A board advertising Lucky Saint, which is the alcohol-free beer. I was a little bit too tired from the day's activity yesterday to really fully take notice of that. But now, it was only after having had like a final pint of Heller's lager, and by the time I got through it, after having done a big beer tasting with some pretty hefty beers in, I was a little bit like, did I really need that last beer? But then when I got back up to my room, I was like, if I'd have been more on it, that little sign they had up for that beer, I didn't even clock it was on draft. I saw the sign, but I didn't take in the fact that they had it on tap there and then. I thought it was just advertising a tap takeover rather than saying we have this on draft. And I think making sure like your signage is clear, because actually the thing I could have done with last night rather than that Helles Lager was an alcohol-free beer just to end the day with. So make sure that's just really clear. And another example based on that was when I was in a coffee house near where I live. They were doing a deal on like buy two coffees and get a free scone. And I'd bought two coffees throughout the course of the morning, and on the second time they said, oh, do you want the free scone? I was like, what free scone? And then they pointed to the sign, which was like way over there, and I was like, I grabbed the sign and put it next to the counter, and I said, that's where that sign needs to be as an upsell. It needs to be there, not over there. The only people who are going to see that over there are people buying cheese from the cheese counter. I'm not buying cheese. You don't sell that much cheese. Put it right where people are paying, and that's going to give them an incentive to buy an extra coffee and get a free scone. Oh, I didn't think of that.
And of course, we know the supermarkets and all, you know, the other
large retailers and particularly petrol forecourts do this very well these days. So why aren't we doing it universally in hospitality? Doesn't matter whether you're an indie operation or not.
The other thing I think about point of sale and the excuse is, oh, but I have to have massive volumes. I have to order like 100 million, 1,000 beer mats. And it's like, no, you don't. Like, there are loads of places now that have minimum order quantities of one, if you want it. Obviously, no one's going to buy a beer mat. But like stuff like Solo Press, if you're UK-based, or Vistaprint, or those places, you can get beer mats that are reasonably cheap and cheerful by, you know, in packs of 25 if you want. I personally think, with any of that sort of stuff, if it's evergreen, like a beer mats, yeah, maybe, and you can afford it, and you are actually going to give them away, then order a reasonable amount. Don't go silly and back, well, we need 400 million. It's like, if you've got 400 million pubs in your estate, great, order 400 million. But if you've only really got 80 customers, you know, buy 800 or what, or 1,000. Just order the quantity you need. And the main thing is get them out there rather than having excess. But the stuff I think where people really fall down on is ordering like flyers and table talkers, etc., that are quite timely. So they'll order them and then they'll have a rebrand, or they'll get rid of one of their main SKUs from the core range. And before you know it, it's out of date and you've just got a massive pile of table talkers that you've paid a lot of money for that are going to be recycled. If they get recycled, they'll probably just sit there in storage somewhere because you can't bear to throw them away because you spent several hundred quid on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all about managing your business at the end of the day, folks. And it is all about the detail. As one of my first bosses told me, every single part of it. As you approach your business, how does it look from the outside? Because you work in it every day. You're the general manager, but how does it look if anybody is walking up to it for the first time in their life and then come through the door, the host and the welcome, and then all the visibility and promotional material needs to be appropriate to your environment.
Yep.
And we all know, actually, you know, we keep mentioning beer mats, we know that in a lot of environments these days, you know, that, so only ask for, just don't waste stuff, you know, don't ask for stuff just because you get it. You'll understand your supplier better and what's on offer. And in fact, they might have stuff that you didn't even know that they had. There's a variation on a beer mat, but you've got to do your own research. And that should be your expectation of your supplier to say, well, actually, what I actually want is branded earrings because I've got an affection for earrings. So do you do them?
I was wondering how you made that sentence.
So I was like, do you do them?
Where is Sean going with that?
And it's like, yeah, we do actually.
We've got a few minutes left before we need to go, and I'd love to talk about small pack briefly. So cans and bottles. I think most people listening to this are going to be aware of the advantages and disadvantages of each, you know, when it comes to shipping and weights. If you've got any other thoughts aside from breakages, etc.
Just everything else that we've just been saying about point of sale, essentially, again, it's, you know, you receive that. The channels in which we can now buy these products, if I'm a take-home customer from a bottle shop through to take home of said beer from the tap room, it's all got to be consistent, it's got to be fun, it's got to be potentially future planned to add, not only in the way, you know, whether it be NFCs through to barcodes and whatever else, in terms of competitions and all that sort of thing to make it interesting. You know, I'm a minimalist, you know, don't confuse the message, make it, you know, attractive, make it well looked after, well sealed. Because again, that's all part of the experience.
What you said about confusion there, I just want to touch upon, because in this beer tasting we ran yesterday, there was one beer brewed by, it was a collab, two well-respected independent breweries in the UK. Very colourful, cartoony can, cracked open, it was an ESB. Absolutely cracking beer, it was one of the favourites that everyone tried. I think we all agreed it was probably, I'd say, within the top three beers, I think. But everybody said, I was expecting a hazy yellow beer when I saw that can. And I think whether you're on that end of the spectrum where it's also, oh man, alien skulls and spaceships, crazy, 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 and then someone opens the beer and it's like brown, bitter or whatever. Or then on the other end of the spectrum where the cans look, I don't want to say traditional, they just look a little bit like not great designs, but it's in a can. And they're trying to do the whole craft beer thing visually, but not really pulling it off. And people are just like, nah, I bet that's not very good. And I've had loads of cans like this. And quite often they're sent to me because as a designer, if I was in a bottle shop, I probably wouldn't choose it myself. You open the can and you're like, that's really fucking good beer. Like, why isn't this brewery getting any notice nationally? Like, they're making great beer. And unfortunately, the aesthetic of it doesn't match the liquid in there on either end. And I think those expectations you set up for someone visually, either with a beer style by calling, oh, this is a hazy IPA, and you crack it open, it's like, well, I can see through it, and it's not really that hoppy. And it only takes a customer, who particularly a discerning customer, a fraction of a second to taste it and think, meh, that's not what I expected. And if it's their first interaction with said brewery and said brand, it will probably be their last.
Absolutely.
I also think something else that brewers should consider is the quality of their, if they're doing label printing. Now, obviously there's digital printing now as well from someone like Oasthouse Engineering where they actually print onto the can, and the quality I've seen in the machine is absolutely amazing. And this really threw me with what I'm about to say. On a label or digitally printed can, the textures that you can adopt just give a little bit more of an uplift if you do that correctly with your designer. So things that are embossed, things that might have a gloss on one bit but a matte on another bit, and the whole feel of something, whether something's got like gold or silver or metallic elements in it, see-through elements, that way you can see the metallic can. I think I'm trying to think of a brewery that does that really well. There is, I think, Lervig or someone like that. I've got a beer in a supermarket which does that.
I'm also a huge fan of everything you did. Just let's really appreciate the creativity here. Let's appreciate the link to the artist or the designer or the subliminal message. It's always formed a part of from the early 1950s. The storyboard is there, and let the customer know the storyboard is there in the can, not just what style and what ingredients, etc., and all the conformity to legality, but there's a message in each can to get your juices going to what you can expect. It's no different to receiving a Christmas present that's beautifully wrapped. And by the way, I have a go at myself there because I'm terrible at wrapping presents.
You see mine.
But we all know we like to receive beautifully wrapped things. And as an example, you know, you might be into Liberty design, for example, and we all know that it's just a huge part of the value add in any product.
Well, I'll finish by saying this, because sat opposite me is a bottle of Coke, and it's in the classic 1950s shape design. Now I've said those words, if you're listening to this, you can picture in your mind what that looks like. Or if I said the word Henderson's Relish, or if I was going to be really blasphemous and say Liam Perrin's Worcestershire Sauce, you instantly know what those bottles look like. And I wonder whether we can get more creative with our small pack, because it's like there are these trends where you get one brewery who moves to a particular size package and everyone does it. Like, why do we need 440ml imperial stouts? We don't. And some people are like, yes, you do. It's like, yeah, all right, if you're sharing them, but there are subsects of drinkers that probably don't need 440ml stouts, imperial stouts, because it's really not good for you. 330ml is more than sufficient. Even 250ml would be sufficient as a taster for that kind of thing. It's not healthy to be drinking a shitload of high ABV beer, to be honest with you, as my gut will attest. And I just wonder if we can get more creative with how we package our beers in small pack, particularly if you're selling direct to consumer, and that is the interface in which people first engage with the beer when they open the box and they're there. Now, obviously, there's not a whole heap you can do with the can in of itself, like the actual vessel, in the way that if you're going to order a bottle, they're more, you know, they have different shapes. Some are more elegant than others. But there's definitely stuff, if you look at Sure Shot, for example, in Manchester, there's infinite amount of things you can do with labels, and now you can do on can printing digitally with minimum order quantities. Some great things you could probably do there.
Absolutely. So, yeah, again, it's like everything else. There's kind of a theme to this podcast, which is that, you know, there are resources out there. They're cheaper than you think, but you've got, it's your responsibility to investigate, explore, and then employ them in a bespoke solution appropriate to your business.
Great. Well, as ever, Sean, it's been great, and it's been brilliant to do this in 3D.
Indeed.
So I think the only way to round off this particular episode, given that we're sat here again this week in the gritty tap room, is to say, Sean, it's been emotional.